Welcome to the Money Maze podcast. I'm Simon Brewer, and Will Campion and I have created this show to explore and unravel some of the mysteries surrounding the investment business. And we hope through direct and insightful interviews with masters of the real-life Money Maze, we're going to learn about different approaches to allocating capital, making investment and business decisions, and navigating the pitfalls that lie in the path to prosperity. And just a quick update, we've recently launched the first of our private podcast series. And if you're interested in listening to the discussion on the topic of litigation funding with Robert Rothkopf of Balanced Legal Capital and myself, then you can find the conversation on our website, moneymazepodcast.com.
I'm Will Campion and co-founder of the Money Maze podcast. And we're delighted to have Schroders as a sponsor and corporate partner. Schroders is a global investment and wealth manager with a purpose to provide excellent performance to clients through active investment management. By serving institutions and individuals worldwide, Schroders serves wider society. Channeling capital into sustainable and durable businesses accelerates positive change in the world. Funding the future is also a privilege. Schroders use it wisely and responsibly. As we know, capital is at risk with investing. Bremont is also a sponsor of the Money Maze podcast. Bremont is an award-winning British company that produces beautifully engineered chronometers designed to appeal to those who share the passion and appreciation of the innovation and mastery behind a beautiful mechanical wristwatch. Brought to you by the luxury British watchmaker Bremont.
Confronted with a kaleidoscope of challenges and potential shifting allocations brought about by years of quantitative easing and zero rates, a rise in inflation that may prove more permanent than the central bankers wish, not to mention rising geopolitical tensions, asset allocators are likely to have their work cut out in the coming years. So today I'm very happy to have Johanna Kirkland, Schroders Group Chief Investment Officer and Global Head of Multi-Assets, as our guest today. Johanna, welcome to the Money Maze podcast.
Hello, Simon. Great to be here today.
Well, I think I'm right in saying that today Schroders is the largest UK active investment manager with 700 billion under management. And you have two roles, global head of multi-assets and group CIO. Some would say one of those was a full-time job, let alone two. And I hope today we can talk about allocating assets in today's environment, from fixed income to equities and alternatives, and also discuss the role of the CIO and its attendant challenges. But I'd like to just jog back. You are half Finnish, half Italian. Now, not surprisingly, that's a first on this show. I could say "Huva humenta" or "Buongiorno," and I think we know which is the nicer language. But you grew up in Rome. You were known as La Fineca, the Finnish one. Why were you in Rome?
So actually, I'm not even Italian. It's just I grew up there. I'm a complete European mongrel, and I won't go into the detail of it. It's just too confusing. But yeah, I grew up in Rome because my parents worked for the United Nations, and the Food and Agriculture Organization specifically had its headquarters there. So having moved around quite a bit, they then settled in Rome when I was born. And so that's why I spent all of my childhood, all of my schooling was in Rome.
And you are educated there until you go to Oxford. So you sort of specialized in fabulous cities steeped in history. Why did you decide to go to Oxford?
Well, it's one of those strange things. I was sitting on the school bus when I was 11 and some other child said, I'm going to go to Oxford. And I said, what is Oxford? And I said, it's the best university in the world. And I remember that moment thinking, okay, I'm going to try and go there too. So I don't know where that came from, but that was a thought I had in my mind. And I was fortunate enough to get a place. And I headed off there when I was 17 with two suitcases, jumped on the plane and left.
And you were only 17 years old?
Yes, because for a long series of circumstances, I think international schools are a bit vague about what year you start. So I started young. In Rome, nobody took gap years and things like that. It just wasn't something people thought of. So I just kept going.
So you find yourself studying PPE and then you get to that moment that, well, some of us remember, I just about remember, where you have to think about a job and something more serious. How did you process that?
My first idea was to do a degree in international relations in the States. And that was kind of my plan A. But I was also concerned about the need to make some money. And I got myself a training contract with one of the big city law firms. And I think as I got into my third year, I mean, one of my tutors, I think, could see that being a solicitor probably wasn't a good idea for me. I don't know how he knew it, but I think he was probably right in the end. I think I would have been a very bad solicitor. I think he felt that I should be focused on other areas. So he actually encouraged me to apply for some other roles. And by accident, there happened to be a role at Morgan Granville that was very big picture, would have very much utilized my degree. It sort of felt almost like being paid to do something I loved. And so I went for it and got the job. So it was almost by accident. That was the only asset management role I applied for. And again, I didn't have much confidence. I don't know if I would have been taken that risk if I hadn't had the support of that tutor at that point in time.
Now, you don't become a global CIO overnight. So tell me about the building blocks that took you from Morgan Granville all the way to today.
So basically, my focus has always been on asset allocation, you know, the big picture. How does it all come together? And as part of that, also, I've always had to have a deep understanding of all the different strategies within the companies I've worked for because I allocate to them. And also to some extent to external strategies, because I have also allocated to external managers in the past as well. And so I guess over the years, what I gradually developed was a good understanding of how everything came together and also what made a good investment process. So I guess unwittingly, it was quite good training for becoming CIO. And in terms of asset allocation, I think for me, when I first started doing it in the 1990s, it was probably the darkest corner of the asset management universe. I mean, I think you were doing it as well at the time. It was very out of favor. And people kept saying to me, when are you going to get a proper job in stock picking? And I think the other thing I would say on asset allocation is people often say, how can you possibly do it? How can you predict the future as if we're sort of sitting around with horoscopes or something? I think asset allocation is really about trying to manage risks you can't diversify away that exist in everybody's portfolio. Equity risk, rate risk, credit risk, commodity risk. And the point is, you can say, well, how can you predict how they're going to perform? But I would say, well, don't you need to have some risk assessment of what's likely to happen to your portfolio? I mean, even if you're buying a house, you do think about, well, what are rates likely to do? How will that impact me relative to everything else I own? Doesn't mean you're trying to predict the future. You're making a risk assessment. It's that mentality, I think, that ultimately, again, probably made me quite well suited to the role of CIO, because I'm not trying to sort of do short-term trading here. Even in asset allocation, it's really taking a strategic view of the risks that we're running as investors.
So let's dig into this asset allocation piece. And I guess this high-level question, because you've got to see a lot of people pursuing specialist mandates, but when we talk about asset allocation mandates, who are the typical clients you engage with and why do they come to Schroders?
So you're right. I mean, there was a big shift away from the balanced funds into specialist funds at the end of the 90s going into 2000. I think we then saw quite a dramatic resurgence in multi-asset starting in the mid-2000s and heading in through the financial crisis. So the kind of clients that will still go for the one-stop solution, if you will, are, first of all, you have, of course, defined contribution investors who are being asked to shoulder an investment burden that's really quite significant. One of the biggest challenges of defined contribution is the lack of engagement by the members. And so actually having someone who can manage all the risks together and help them through that path to retirement is actually quite useful. So we see a lot of demand in defined contribution. We've also seen significant demand from insurers, for example, looking to outsource their books, again, needing someone to bring it all together. So that's been a huge source of growth for us. The other challenge has been, of course, a dearth of income. Once upon a time, you could even sit in cash and generate a yield. You could certainly buy government bonds. In the absence of those yields, people have been pushed up the risk curve, traditionally quite conservative investors. And again, multi-asset has stepped in to help those investors move up the risk curve, bringing in risks they're not used to and helping them to manage the volatility. And then the final thing that I found very interesting is actually very, very significant, sophisticated institutions who have a lot of resource of their own, who typically use this as a sort of benchmark for their own capability and also as a form of knowledge transfer. Because again, although the asset management industry might have splintered into specialist mandates, the asset owners are still having to manage a very broad range of risks. And in some sense, in the move away from balanced funds, lost a sort of support from the asset management community. And that has been an area, again, where we've been quite active, where big asset owners are asking us, how do you do it? How do you think about the risks? How do you create the investment culture? Why do they choose Schroders? I think it's because we do have very significant resources in this area. We're willing to adapt to different client needs. I think for me, I always said, my best ideas come from my clients. Speaking to them, seeing what their challenges are, typically is what triggers me to come up with an idea. They are my inspiration. And I think that's probably why we tend to do quite well in multi-asset Schroders, because we're willing to understand high level of client empathy and are willing to adapt our capabilities to the needs of different investors. Even if it's knowledge transfer, literally giving them our models, we're there to serve. And I think that comes across quite strongly.
So let's talk about those different components, and let's start with fixed income. We all know we live in a yieldless, and in real terms, much worse than that. How do you justify owning fixed income in these portfolios?
I mean, we used to get a yield from fixed income and also a negative correlation in a crisis, which of course was wonderful while it lasted. And then in recent years, we got used to lower yields, but still that negative correlation. I think what people are disputing now is the stability of that negative correlation. And I think that we have to be willing to accept that actually that negative correlation might be not as stable anymore because we're potentially moving into a more inflationary regime. But that ultimately there's still a role for bonds as a source of yield in the portfolio and a lower volatility source of return. And so what we've been doing is essentially moving into riskier bonds to generate that yield. Because the thing we must remember is in a zero rate world, it is very important to earn some yield. It's a very important source of stability in the portfolio. So I still think there's a role for bonds. You have to move up the risk curve. You need to focus on the yield. But I do think there's a role for bonds in the portfolio still.
We're going to come back to inflation in a little bit. Let's just go to the next and what's become the most central building block, equities. And there's a lot of 500-foot observation about expensive markets, perhaps distorted by the US valuations because there's significant dispersion in valuation, both by sector and by country. And how are you thinking about that?
I think the sort of two-tier market, if you will, is typical of an environment where growth ultimately is scarce in some form. So we saw it, for example, in the 70s. We saw it in Japan in the 1990s. In a world where growth is scarce, those companies that can deliver superior earnings will attract a premium. And that's why I think we have dispersion in valuations. Now, what could change, I guess, is if rates start to rise, clearly that would affect some of those stocks that are more expensive, potentially. But my bias is to think that we're still going to be in a fairly narrow market environment where you're going to continue to see these dispersions. And the reason is because we're seeing very profound disruption, technological, ecological, political. And so I think that that, again, creates winners and losers. And also, again, I think there is a threat of some kind of stagflationary environment where ultimately we're still going to struggle to have very strong growth globally. So all in all, I actually think we're going to continue to have two-tier markets. I think that's likely to continue.
Well, if we just stay with that dispersion, and here we are both having this interview in the UK, I think Schroeder's authored a piece recently called Why Investors Are Ignoring UK Shares. You're dealing with a group of investors in part who have UK liabilities. How do you balance that UK value equation with what you've just said about scarcity of growth?
Well, we generally have been avoiding the UK market for that reason. I mean, it's looked cheap for a long time. But we have generally favoured the US. We call it reassuringly expensive. It delivers us the growth that we need. In that equation, probably we'd still be tilted more towards the S&P 500 than to the UK. I think the other critical view is what happens to sterling, because of course, ever since Brexit, we've also had quite a weak currency. So overseas allocations have been helpful to retail investors. And again, I don't see any reason for sterling to be particularly strong relative to the other major currencies for the foreseeable future. Not going to collapse anymore the way it did post-Brexit, but I think there are good reasons why other currencies will be stronger.
Okay, so then staying with that, looking around the world, Schroders have a big business in Asia. One is very conscious that China is intriguing for all sorts of reasons, geopolitical from valuation. I was just running through some of the numbers, and I think the Chinese 8 shares as a universe offer what most people would say is compelling value. Many are on 8% dividend yields with sound balance sheets and pretty strong cash flows. We've got this, if you like, juxtaposition of political tensions, which may not go away. Interference, perhaps one would say, in terms of the desire of the authorities to interfere with large tech platform companies in a way we haven't seen in the US. But investors are seeking returns and there's a lot of growth in that part of the world. How are you balancing those competing forces?
When it comes to China, I think it is one of the leaders in technological innovation, one of the few that can really compete with the United States on this front. So I suspect we'll continue to see opportunities there in China. The challenge is that they are looking to recalibrate growth. I think some of the moves they've made have actually been quite sensible. I mean, I'd be quite happy if we constrained the use of video games in this country. You know, I have a 12-year-old boy. And I think the rule of constraint to 3 hours is quite a good one. So I think that we're having to apply a political risk premium now to Chinese stocks. It creates systemic risk in the sense that you're much more reliant on one dominant player, which is the Chinese authorities. But again, I think it is still a source of opportunity. So long term, we're positive on China. And actually, ultimately, I see this as a fairly sensible recalibration. It's interesting that even in the West, we are now more focused. So in China, they call it common prosperity. In the States, they call it inclusive growth. In some sense, we're all responding to the same challenge that years of quantitative easing have disproportionately benefited the upper end of the income scale, but that is not sustainable. So actually, I see the Chinese moves as a particular Chinese version of a trend that I can see globally.
Underlying all of this is the passive-active debate. Schroders is a champion of the active space. I think in the case of China, 40% of the market that's not researched, which you would argue creates opportunity. How are you thinking about taking advantage of an active expertise that you have?
At the core of what we do is active management. And I think partly it's just a mindset of constantly looking to innovate and stay relevant. And I think you need that in the market. I sometimes use passive exposures in some of my portfolios. I think the two coexist. But you need to have people striving to beat the market, because I think there is where a lot of innovation lies. It can then get commoditized by the passive industry. But I think in the absence of the active industry, we'd be losing a lot of innovation. So that's my first point about active. I think that that's the role it plays. How can we deploy it right now? I mean, I mentioned earlier, more of a two-tier market, winners and losers, high levels of disruption. That does require an active view of where things are moving. Again, the incorporation of sustainability, the risk of carbon pricing moving. All of these things are quite fundamental. I think for many years, we were all looking at the same data, the standard accounting measures, which again had been also commoditized by the passive industry. And what we're learning now is that we have to use a much broader range of data. So obviously we had the pandemic, suddenly we had to look at data on the virus and process that, the assessment of ESG risks. All these things require the use of data that hasn't been used up until now. I've really seen such a profound shift in the last few years compared to the previous 20 years that I was in the industry. And I think that's the opportunity for active, is to actually make use of all of that data and gain an edge in that way.
When we move from the traditional building blocks of asset allocation, cash, stocks, bonds, all of the lack of appetizing returns in the fixed income world have driven people increasingly to the alternatives. And one component of that, whether they should rightly belong under that umbrella or not, are hedge funds. And I was listening to Goldman Sachs CIO on an asset allocation committee I sit in, and they made the statement they wouldn't allocate to hedge funds because they think hedge funds have lost their alpha. And I wonder whether that the danger of making that statement is a byproduct of a 20-year bull market where any hedge fund manager who's hedged out beta has underperformed the index. How do you approach that question of hedge funds?
One thing I would agree with, there's some people who trying to replace the role that government bonds used to play with hedge funds. And I don't think that works. I think the stability of the correlations is not the same. The level of complexity is completely different. The level of fees is completely different. So I think trying to identify a positive carry hedge like that government bonds was for a long time through the use of hedge fund strategies, I think we just need to accept that you can't find an easy replacement for government bonds. Given that valuation is expensive, I do believe, though, that it's a good idea to start to diversify your sources of return. So in that sense, I'm interested potentially in hedge funds, really looking for strategies which exploit inefficiencies that I couldn't access myself. But as I said, I wouldn't use them as a hedge against markets falling. I really don't think that's a good idea.
Underlying this, of course, is, and you mentioned it, and we've spoken quite a bit of it on this show, is inflation. I'm reminded of George Soros, who said, discount the obvious and expect the unexpected. How is your asset allocation thinking changing, and how might it change over the next 12 months?
Firstly, in simple terms, and again, this is a good example of asset allocation as a form of risk management. For the last decade, based on the analysis we did, we saw deflationary bias to our forecasts. Again, we weren't exactly predicting the future, but based on a fairly objective assessment of the risks, it seemed there was a bit of a deflationary bias. And in that environment, commodities are not additive at all to the portfolio because they're very correlated with equity. And it's very unlikely that they'll be performing when equities are falling. So they really don't offer much diversification benefit. Over the last year, based on the same assessment, we now think there's a potentially more inflationary bias to our forecasts. And that means that from the beginning of the year, we've been owning commodities as an allocation in our portfolio. Because if you're in a more inflationary regime, there are environments where equities might struggle and commodities can do well. So that's a simple thing, a simple shift that's happened in our portfolios. as a result of an assessment of the shift in the risks of deflation versus inflation. So I think that's number one. I think the other thing we need to think about is exactly what equities you own. Again, I mean, I don't believe we're going back to the 1970s, but I think we're in an environment which is somewhat more stagflationary, again, where those companies that can maintain pricing power are going to outperform. Being more specific about what equities you own, I think strategies that rely on breadth of the market are going to struggle. I think more thematic allocations can help to identify pockets of the market where pricing power might still be intact. And again, I think active approaches to harnessing themes are more effective. So those are some of the things that we've been thinking about as a consequence of a reassessment of the inflation risk.
So I'd like to talk about the organization in relation to you being the chief investment officer. Given Schroeder's scale, I would really like to know how you organize yourself and your team. You oversee equity, debt, and other assets. There's a vast geographical spread. You want to achieve consistency. How do you do it?
I think, first of all, I work as a team with other people. So, for example, the different asset class heads. And that obviously is enormously helpful. Secondly, it's important to understand that at Schroeder's, responsibility for investment performance really resides at the level of the desk head in each strategy, because it is important for each investor to be held accountable for their performance. We don't have a house view, so I'm not here to tell each investor what their view on rates should be. Rather, what I'm here to do is ensure that we're supporting them with the platform, ensuring they have the appropriate resources, that their teams are working well, and that their attitude to risk is appropriate given the market environment. So with that lens, actually, it does become more manageable. And there's some critical moments in the lifecycle of a strategy where I'm likely to be more involved. First, at the inception of the strategy, ensuring that to the extent we're innovating, we're leveraging best practice across the firm. And then, depending on market conditions, either if performance is very good, which in itself might be a cause for alarm, or performance is very bad, intervening to help the relevant fund manager get back on track.
And where you get, and we can debate whether we are at an inflection point with inflation or not, but when we get an asset paradigm shift and one which may be deeply hostile for fixed income investors, do you find yourself then having to shift more to work with and spend time with those? It might be the fixed income investors along with the growth investors, but how do you respond in terms of a CIO role to such events?
So in the case of inflation, which you're absolutely right, I think we are potentially in the midst of a paradigm shift with regard to inflation and policy more broadly. What we aim to do is ensure that we're really sharing information. You know, the worst case scenario is one where everyone is independently doing their own analysis on inflation and not really benefiting from the richness of insights that are being generated across the investment teams. So to deal with that paradigm shift, my job is to ensure that the different teams are collaborating, sharing the insights they're generating from the bottom up, the companies they're visiting, or a macroeconomic analysis, and then providing that information to everybody so that then they, again, can make the best decisions for each of their strategies.
When you think about those various moving parts, what would you say is the one that you find most difficult?
It used to be, in some sense, the dissemination of information, getting people into a room. And funny enough, that has been resolved by remote working. So one benefit of remote working is that actually now joining a meeting to listen to the insights being shared, the hurdle rate's quite low now because you can do it from your desk. You don't have to go and join another meeting room. You don't have to stand in a room with 30 people. You can actually just dial into a call at a time that's convenient to you and hear what the best thinking is within the firm, for example, on the development of the coronavirus or on inflation statistics. And so actually that has been quite helpful. That's been facilitated by the more flexible approach to working. Or once upon a time, you would have had to have organized a big meeting, and a lot of fund managers don't really want to be sat in big meetings.
The topic that recurs in conversations that I have is the inclusion or exclusion as a function of the ESG debate. And I just wondered where you stand on that, particularly as we think about that yieldless world. And now we put on top of that the energy complex and the dilemma and the question of whether you want to be handing over your shareholding in a BP or Shell to a passive fund or whether you want to be actively involved. How do you weigh that up?
We want to stay actively involved. So we believe in engagement, not divestment. I think that there are a number of challenges. First of all, I think we can make more of an impact by working with companies. Obviously, we're not going to own every company in the sector. That's the benefit of an active approach. You engage with the companies that are embracing the transition, understanding some of the changes that need to be made, and are willing to work with you to achieve that change. And that's a very important part, by the way, of moving to a lower carbon future. You have to bring everyone on the journey with you. That, I think, is really fundamental for us. I think also from the perspective of generating investment performance, we need to be careful, because if you go down an exclusionary approach, you start to narrow your universe, and there'll be potentially too many assets, too much money chasing too few investment opportunities. You could end up with bubble-like conditions in some of these stocks. While if you have the ability to do the analysis and identify what we called underpriced transition at stock level, I think there's the opportunity to move in the right direction from, say, an environmental perspective, but also generate superior returns. Those are two simple reasons why we're very much focused on engagement rather than divestment. And we don't believe in an exclusionary approach.
And how active do you want to get? And I'm thinking here about Japanese companies that have historically not been enthusiastic about having female representation on the board. How much do you want to push and cajole them to reassess that position?
When we're assessing a company, we're looking at a whole range of issues on which we could engage. And obviously, the diversity on boards is one of them. We have to accept their cultural differences so you can make your voice heard. But again, one of the strengths of Schroders, I think, has been to always understand, particularly Japan. You know, I remember in the 1990s, one heard in finance circles a very American opinion of how Japan had to get out of its problems. And actually, I think the world is diverse itself, and there are some differences across borders on things like gender diversity and other social issues. The aim is to generally move in the right direction, but accept that people are moving at different speeds.
10 years before that, they'd upheld Japanese quality circles, and maybe 15 years, but Japan is the paradigm of excellence whilst the US laboured. So short-termism is common to the investment management industry. Before we talk about the role of the CIO and the CIO office, I want to just come back to the inflation question. There are two assets that occupy lots of conversation, gold and crypto. And I think that you and I might be on the same page when it comes to the value of owning gold. I don't want to prejudge that. Are you getting pressure or more questions asked about should crypto be in those portfolios?
I wouldn't say in institutional circles it's something that people are discussing yet. So we're not under any pressure to buy crypto. I think it's something we need to continue to analyze, though, more because of the underlying technology, the blockchain technology, the decentralized ledger. I think it could have profound consequences for the finance industry. So again, I mean, I never believe in just ignoring trends. I always want to be part of them. I always want to understand them. Because if you think about when we first started having internet sites, the real innovation really started, the real revolution happened when you combined the internet with a smartphone. I mean, that was almost inconceivable back in 1999, 2000. And I think, again, the real power of innovation will be a combination of technologies which could well include blockchains. I see the currency as a sort of symptom of the underlying revolution that's happening there. And we're not allocating to it, but we are developing tools to understand currencies, cryptocurrencies, to value them. We are collecting data. We're trying to understand the trend towards digitalization and things like that.
And given that you're actually paid to own gold in euros with negative rates in Euroland right now, does gold feature in your allocation?
So the way we think about gold is it's correlated with real yields. The challenge right now is obviously yields have already got very negative. So we've owned gold quite a lot over the last few years. But now we're at a point where the risk we think is that real yields could rise a bit because people might be underappreciating the extent to which you might see rates going up. So gold works essentially because it's correlated with real yields. It works when rates are falling faster than inflation, and also works when inflation is rising much faster than rates are. But there's a bit in the middle where rates are going up where actually it can behave a bit like fixed income. So it's not completely linear. So right now we don't have allocations, but it's absolutely something we include in our portfolios on a regular basis.
This, as CIO, you run a team that oversees £700 billion of assets. It's an enormous sum. What's the biggest challenge as a CIO?
The biggest challenge is that accountability for performance ultimately, I think, always has to be at desk head level. People need to own all the risk in their portfolios. But obviously, as CIO, you're responsible for the performance of the platform overall. So how can you make change without just basically overriding the individual for managers? At Schroders, we don't have a house view, again, because we believe that accountability rests at desk head level. And certainly, I'm not here to override individual fund manager decisions. So what you have to do is create the right environment that basically allows the fund managers themselves to recognize their mistakes early and make adjustments themselves when needed. And to create that kind of environment, you need to encourage situations where there's a lot of peer scrutiny. You have to create a culture where people are willing to share their concerns and their challenges, so that ultimately, as I said, we recognize mistakes more quickly. I actually think investment processes exist to cope with when we get things wrong. When things are going well, it's quite easy, the decisions you have to make. The difficult decisions are when you're getting it wrong. And that's why you need process for that, to basically deal with the behavioral challenges of making decisions when you're losing money.
I suppose that makes me want to ask you what keeps you up at night.
Fortunately, I sleep very well at night. Probably just as well. So that's the first step. I think if you have the kind of job I have, I think excessive worrying is not going to get you anywhere. So I sleep like a baby at night. But to answer your question more seriously, ultimately, I think if we do get into a major regime shift, combined with also the emphasis on ESG, it's all happening at the same time. I really feel we could end up with some unusual consequences, that the last 20 years have followed a fairly similar pattern. Even the financial crisis, as extreme as it was, ultimately bonds still protected. Certain assets behaved in certain ways. I think basically it's the uncertainty of the correlation structure looking ahead.
So let me just push you a bit. Those unusual consequences, just spell some of them out.
Well, for example, so it's a big question about what happens with inflation and then also how the central banks react, because there's a question mark about whether they can even afford to raise rates because of the stretched government finances. And I think at the same time, we're also integrating all these ESG risks. There's a question about what happens with carbon pricing. So we've just spent the last 30 years focused on the rate cycle, 40 years. It could be the rate cycle ends up being flat because they can't afford to raise rates. You know, it goes up 50 basis points, but basically very little volatility on that front. And that actually approaches to carbon could be a major policy shift, which we're still getting our heads around. Obviously, I wasn't thinking about markets at the time, but it must have been 70s and 80s as people tried to understand how monetary policy was going to operate. And that's how I feel about carbon. So that's an example of something that could have very profound consequences, could lead to a more protectionist world, and could impact pretty much every stock in our universe.
And when we talk about the asset management business, I was looking at Schroders' stock price, which I think I'm right in saying over the last 10 years has outperformed the UK index by 200%. What do you think is going to happen to the asset management business over the next 5+ years?
For me, the big theme is that we have to continue to be as flexible as possible to our client needs. In some sense, the asset management industry for a long time benefited from the huge scalability of big pooled funds. And the challenge now is that customers are demanding more flexible approaches. And the ability to do that, it does require more resource. To compete now in asset management, you really need to have significant breadth of resource to create that flexibility in what you offer the client, and very significant depth of resource to basically access all the different kinds of data you need to access to invest in the research in such a disrupted world.
I'd like to switch to the topic we discussed on this show a bit, which is encouraging women to be in finance in positions of importance. We had Tilly Franklin, the CIO at Cambridge, on the show. You said something earlier on, is you weren't sure that you had the confidence to start in this industry. Maybe just tell me a little bit about why that was, and has it changed, and why are we still talking about it?
Why do I lack the confidence? It's hard to analyze yourself, but I guess the industry I entered in the 90s didn't have many people like me. And I remember feeling impossibly awkward for many years and struggling to speak in meetings, probably for the first decade of my career. And looking back, I think that maybe, and I don't know whether it's because I'm a woman or just because of my upbringing, but I found a lot of the conversations were very adversarial, putting people down. I still remember the times people did it to me, and I just found it so humiliating. I can't imagine why anyone would enjoy it, but it seems to be quite prevalent, certainly, in some of the investment debates I witnessed. When did things turn for me? Well, I guess there was a moment I remember in the early 2000s where I thought to myself, I don't fit in, but I don't fancy having a sex change, so I'm just going to have to keep going as I am. That was step one, is just saying, I am who I am. And then the next step was saying, well, surely, this particularly when I had children, I thought, if I give up, is going to be just as hard for the next woman who comes along. So I thought, I really need to stick it out here. I have to do it for my daughter. I have to be here, because I think the more of us are here, the easier it'll get. And then I got to a point where I was driving the meetings, and I did develop, I think, a much less adversarial approach. I'd like to think that nobody in my meetings gets humiliated. And actually, it means we still have great debates, but it's never personal. And so that's created an environment that I'm happier operating in. And I think others are also happier operating in. I think for management in particular, it's a great career for a woman. Combined it with children, I think it lends itself to that, because the kind of decisions you're making are long term compared to, say, corporate law, which is, the hours are very difficult. So I'm very thankful that I didn't go down the path of being a solicitor and that I became a fund manager. I think it's a great career for women.
So having had a front row seat to watch many of the problems which came about from business having been done with regard to female employees in a certain way for a long time, how did you want to shift things to recognise some of these challenges and to learn from your own experiences?
Well, as I said, I think in some sense, the objective for me in the first half of my career was just to survive and be in the industry. I felt that was the biggest thing I could do for other women, was just to be there as a female investor. And in order to do that, I had to fit in with the framework that I was given, which really didn't make any allowance for being a mother of young children. And I think that the second half of my career, as I've taken on responsibility for the management of investment teams, I've been quite focused on actually changing the framework to making it more flexible. So I'll give you a simple example. We used to have a morning meeting within my multi-asset team that was at 8 a.m. in the morning. We frequently had internal meetings that started at 8 a.m. And as a parent, that's quite a problematic time. It puts quite a lot of pressure on the morning, causes quite a lot of difficulty with daycare or any kind of childcare you might have in place. And actually, there's no real reason why internal meetings need to start at 8. Of course, if a client wants to speak to me at 8, I'm always available, or earlier, in fact. But a routine internal meeting, in my view, doesn't need to start at 8 in the morning. So I moved any routine internal meeting to start at 9 a.m. And that simple change made it much easier for working mothers and actually for all working parents, because I think the benefit of creating a more inclusive environment is it benefits everyone. It isn't just about focusing on women or focusing on ethnic minorities. It's actually about accepting that everybody is trying to optimize their work-life balance in some way. Everybody wants different things. And if you can create a bit of give in the system, that benefits everybody.
Yes. And I think it is also a reflection of some of the advantages for people thinking about joining the buy side, the asset management side, rather than the sell side, which historically, certainly the sell side has required that sort of earlier arrival, although one might argue the sell side continues to be disintermediated and replaced with electronic messaging, etc. But that's another conversation.
Yeah, but you're absolutely right about that. I think that ultimately we have to attract the best talent we can. And I think that these days people are demanding a different way of working. And I think those firms that can provide that flexibility will benefit from better access to talent. This is something we talk about a lot.
Well, I have two daughters, 19 and 21. I'll make sure they're listening to your advice today, which I think is excellent. Generally, advice for women joining financial services?
My advice that I'd give to women is the same I'd give to men, because again, men also are very different. I always just remember how awkward I felt. So I think there's some who come in feeling confident, maybe arrogant. That certainly wasn't my problem. So whenever I speak to graduates, I'm always saying, look, if you're feeling awkward and out of place, I felt that way for 10 years. And I inched my way along like a tortoise. I wasn't bold. I struggled a lot. And I always say that to people, it does get better and you do get more comfortable, and just stretch yourself a little bit every single day. Just practice. My number one piece of advice for people entering the financial services industry. More broadly, I think it's always important to understand who we're serving, remembering who the clients are. I think that, again, fund management can attract egos, people trying to prove how clever they are. That's not what we're here to do. We're here to deliver better returns and outcomes for our clients. And that is also, I think, very important context.
So a few closing general questions. What do you like to read?
So I read a lot of fiction because I like to sort of disappear into another world. But I think that probably my favorite book, which I always come back to, I have it on my bedside table, is a book by Kurt Vonnegut called Play a Piano. And he wrote it, I think, in 1951 or 1952. I found it at one of my parents' bookshelves 20 years ago. And I thought what was interesting about it was that it's sort of science fiction, but it's a world driven by engineers and everyone else is out of a job because everything's been mechanized. And in some sense, presaged what has actually happened. And I find some of the quotes incredibly insightful. So that's a book I turn to a lot, quite a fan of Kurt Vonnegut, but generally fiction is what I read because I think it stretches you to places that maybe you can't imagine. In that sense, I find it very thought-provoking.
And there's a book that we've quoted on the show before, a lovely little book called If You Could Tell Us Just One Thing. And there are a number of people asked that question. They haven't got a chapter with you in it yet, but if you could tell us just one thing.
I think you have to try and harness who you are. So actually, one of my favorite quotes is by Dolly Parton, which is basically work out who you are and then do it on purpose or something like that. I remember even my father over 20 years ago, when I was struggling to speak in the office, he said, just be yourself. And I thought, but that's not going to be enough. And I actually think if you channel who you are and do it more deliberately and try and channel the best parts of you, typically you're swimming with the tide. It's much easier than trying to pretend you're someone you're not. So I think ultimately being authentic, I have many faults, but I've just tried to work with them. Try and channel my personality in the best way I can. And where I have weaknesses, I try and find people who don't have those weaknesses so they can work with me and help me. So I think understand who you are and then build your life around that is probably my one thing.
And finally, what's the challenge you think you all will want to undertake at some point in your life?
A couple of things. I mean, I've always wanted to write a book. I'm quite a bookworm. I think the other thing is I spent the first 20 or so years of my life in Italy, and then I've spent the last 25 years here in the UK. And I would like to live in another country because for me, that sort of cultural challenge is something that helps you to grow, I think.
Yes. Well, I am going to take two things in particular away from this conversation that struck me as being perhaps, you know, not always said, but very important. One is that the investment process is most relevant for when it's going wrong. And I think that sometimes it's seen as a box-ticking exercise and a way to sort of pass the gates in an institutional review. And then for advice for all people, particularly young people, your point on confidence, stretch yourself a little bit every day. Allied to that with some good reading, and then a lot of people might be in good shape. So that's great. So Johanna, thank you so much for being with us today on the Money Maze podcast. It's been really terrific to talk to you.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Money Maze podcast. For more information or to subscribe, please visit themoneymazepodcast.com. Hope to see you next time. All content on the Money Maze podcast is for your general information and use only and is not intended to address your particular requirements. In particular, the content does not constitute any form of advice, recommendation, representation, endorsement, or arrangement, and is not intended to be relied upon by users in making any specific investment or other decisions. Guests and presenters may have positions in any of the investments discussed.